I'm not happy about this, but I'm just trying to report honestly. The traditional categories of Christian theology made Jesus less interesting to me.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Brian McLaren. He's the author of a number of books, and his most recent is Do I Stay Christian? A Guide for the Doubters, the Disappointed, and the Disillusioned. I was just really excited to be able to have this conversation with someone whose books that I have read many of and whom I've appreciated and admired for many years. We also recently included some comments from Brian in an essay at a Public Witness called Did the Fundamentalist Win?, which is a look back at the last century of religion and politics and the successes of fundamentalism. You can find that essay and many others and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. So now here's my conversation with Brian McLaren on Do I Stay Christian? Well, Brian, first of all, welcome to the program.
So happy to be with you.
And I got to say, you have a great name, so.
I was thinking the same thing, and we both had the good fortune to have our parents spell it correctly as well as choosing a great name.
That's right. Well, I'm really excited to talk with you. I have been reading your books for a long time, and we're going to be talking about your newest, Do I Stay Christian? A Guide for the Doubters, the Disappointed, and the Disillusioned. And I know it's probably not fair to ask the question so simply of, well, do you?
It's complicated, but yes, I still identify as a Christian, but I'm hoping that in the process of writing this book, I'm a little clearer about what that entails after 2,000 years of Christian history.
Yeah, you know, I think we should set the stage a little bit. Your last book was Faith After Doubt. And yes, in many ways, this book is building on some of the issues, particularly thinking about some of the stages. So yes, for those that either didn't read that book or read it too long ago and kind of forgot about it, I wonder if we could set the stage here, the interview, with these stages, particularly those later stages that are so important for understanding Do I Stay Christian?
Yes, yes. Well, I'm really glad you asked that. And in fact, in this book, I have a chapter where I summarize that whole book, Faith After Doubt, in that four-stage framework, because I think it really is useful to have some framework of human development. And before I'll give you a very brief explanation, but I always like to say that any model of developmental stages is a tool, and every tool can be really useful, but it can also be turned into a weapon. So we have to be aware that that even a useful tool can be weaponized. What I did is I over the years became intrigued with stages of human development, and I read a lot of different theorists, some Christian, some secular. Some focusing on religion, some focusing on race, some focusing on just intellectual development. And I saw a pattern, a four-stage pattern emerge. And I call these four stages simplicity, complexity, perplexity, and harmony. Super easy to remember. Of course, we would start with simplicity. We inherit from our parents what we need as children to survive. And what we need is to be able to put things in categories of two. Is this safe or dangerous? Is that person a friend or a stranger? Is this yummy or yucky? Is this, am I happy or sad? Is this activity allowed or prohibited? So we learn these simple binaries, and that's simplicity. And that's when we say raising children, we mean raising them at least into simplicity. A lot of people stay there their whole lives, and a lot of religious communities only work in that framework of simplicity. More and more people, I think, at a younger and younger age, move out of simplicity into complexity. And if you think of it like this, when I was a little boy, I learned simplicity from my family, but we had some friends across the street, And I became friends with these two brothers, and I'd go over to their house, and I realized that they had a slightly different set of simple rules and they had a different set of authority figures. And around the block, I had another friend and her family had another set. So when you realize, a lot of people have a lot of different simplicities that they're working with, and I have to navigate when I'm at whose house, which set of rules am I living by? And I might still believe mine are right or the best, but I also just have to deal with the complexities of a world where not everybody's the same. That's complexity. You might think of simplicity as dualism and complexity as pragmatism. How do I get along? How do I make things work? A lot of people stay there their whole lives. I personally think the megachurch phenomenon is largely a stage two phenomenon. It never challenges stage one, but it gets on with how do we live? How do we get along? Stage three, more and more people, I think, reach at a younger and younger age. And you know you've reached stage three when you look back and say, a lot of those simple binaries that my authority figures gave me are wrong, or they're really incomplete, or they might help some people, but then they hurt other people. And we think a lot of those easy steps to success that I learned in stage two, we didn't ever really think deeply enough about what success really is. And so when you begin to critique your own group, you know that you're moving into stage three. In stage one and stage two, you critique other groups. But in stage three, you critique your own group. And when that happens, again, many people stay there their whole lives. But eventually, some people are ready to move on from just critiquing. And they think, okay, I've critiqued. Now what am I going to do? How am I going to live? And that brings many people to stage four, which I call harmony or solidarity. And harmony, because I no longer have to judge everybody for being at a different place. I just say, of course, they're at a different place. And I feel a sense of solidarity with them. I maybe was brought up fundamentalist Christian, but I have a friend who's brought up fundamentalist Muslim. And I think he was brought up in a different setting, but I have a sense of, I understand what it's like to grow up in the way he grew up. And I try to find a sense of empathy and connection, solidarity with people. So those are the four stages. And the way that sets the stage for this book, Do I Stay Christian, is that we have a lot of churches that help people in stage one. And as soon as you don't fit in stage one, you don't fit in that church. We have more and more churches that work for people in stage two. As soon as you begin to critique, you are not welcome there. And so what's happening is a lot of people in the process of maturing feel they're outgrowing Christianity, that there's no place in Christianity that has room for them. And that's the problem I'm addressing in the book.
Yeah, I mean, that resonates a lot with me. In fact, your Faith After Doubt is a book that we have discussed in my Sunday school class, and all of us have hit at least that stage three level. So in fact, we call our class the margins. We are the margins class, the margins of the church.
That's great.
And so, yeah, it would probably be a little uncomfortable for stage one to stage two. And so, you know, the question then you're asking, like, do I stay Christian, is a pretty fundamental question then when you start getting to that stage three level of, yeah. Well, you know, wait a minute, you know, I mean, obviously there's some great things here, but there's also a lot of things that I'm wrestling with or I'm struggling with, or I just don't accept.
Yes. Yes. For me, in my own story, it really happened at a young age because I loved science and I read science books as for fun. And I just had this insatiable curiosity, whether it was learning about stars and astronomy or dinosaurs and fossils or reptiles and birds. I just loved to learn about all of that. And when I found out that in my church, you were not allowed to believe in evolution, you had to believe in literal six-day creation, I remember thinking, okay, how many more years till I turn 18 and I'll be out of here? And a lot of people, it might be different issues, but a lot of people just feel this isn't going to work out for me.
Obviously, the context in which you're writing this book also seems really significant. I mean, the last couple of years, we have COVID, and you acknowledge that in the book and the impact that that has had. Not only did we have at least a million now Americans and several million globally people that have died, and all of this, you know, pain and sorrow that's in our communities that's sometimes not even really being properly dealt with and acknowledged. But we had some churches that, you know, refused to take appropriate health measures. There were even anti-mask, anti-vaccine, you know, making the pandemic worse. We had the January 6th insurrection, where you had people violently attacking our Capitol while carrying Christian flags and Jesus signs. I mean, so like you're writing this question and wrestling with this question of, do I stay Christian at a time when, I mean, your book goes a lot deeper, a lot further back in history in wrestling with these questions, but really even just the last 2 years, you could ask a really tough question of, do I stay Christian in this culture?
In the last 2 days, even, because we're talking in the aftermath of the big revelation about Southern Baptist cover-ups that are almost identical to Roman Catholic cover-ups and of sexual abuse. And when a Roman Catholic cardinal forbade Nancy Pelosi to receive the Eucharist, and when there was another mass shooting, a tragic mass shooting in Texas, and many, many Christians, a rabbi friend of mine said, it's wrong to say that this man acted alone. He didn't act alone. He acted with the support of millions of people who are unwilling to do anything to try to protect children, because they value the rights to have assault weapons more than the safety of children. And so these things happen, and many of the people who support these things, like the January 6th insurrection, they have a Bible in one hand, and I think about a t-shirt I saw just down the road from where I live, and it had the guy had a picture of a big Bible right in the middle of his chest and a handgun, equal-sized handgun, right under the Bible. And I guess that said it all. It's Bible and a gun.
Yeah, I guess I'm not surprised that literally I was going to be asking you about those moments that you just mentioned from this week. So I'm not surprised that you're already, you know, reflecting on them as well. I mean, I grew up Southern Baptist. I pastored a Southern Baptist church. I'm still Baptist, but I no longer am Southern Baptist. And so, you know, reading through that report and seeing the systemic cover-up and the concern more for denominational power and denominational money than for the children. And then you mentioned the over-politicization and partisanization of our faith, with the example with Pelosi. And then, you know, I mean, this morning, you know, last night we had, late yesterday afternoon, there was the news on the shooting. And as we're talking the day after this morning, as I'm seeing the update, and it's, you know, 2 fourth grade teachers, and it's a bunch of fourth graders. Yeah. And then I sent my son to fourth grade this morning.
Wow. I can only imagine.
Yeah. And so, you know, you name the question really well, because I think there are a lot of us who grew up in the church and desperately want to cling to the teachings of Jesus. But when we look at the Christians, the denominations, the quote Christian politicians in our country, it's hard to stay Christian.
And that's why there's something like 70 million adults in the United States now, out of our total population of about 330 million. So this is a lot of people, about 70 million adults who grew up with some kind of church connection, and now they have none. So sometimes since childhood and adulthood, one thing too many happened, and they just said, I'm finished with this. About 2.7 million more people join that number every year. And I have a feeling years like this might accelerate the number. And of course, you know, for those of us who do stay Christian, we can't help but recall Jesus' words that by their fruits you shall know them, not by their doctrinal statements, not by their sexual orientation, or not by which side they take in the culture war. By their fruit you shall know them. And then he said, you know, if salt if you're supposed to be the salt of the earth and you lose your savor, then if you don't taste right, then people just throw you out and trample underfoot. And so we sort of see that happening. And it ironically proves that Jesus was right. And it proves that something's wrong with us. And that is a hard pill for a lot of people to swallow.
Yeah, you mentioned this phenomenon. And I mean, we all know the data of younger generations walking out of the church, particularly millennials, Gen Z. I happen to be, according to the definitions of millennial, I'm one of the oldest millennials there are, you know, born in the first couple of weeks of the start of the millennial generation. And I mean, I feel like a lot of times we hear this, the question in churches is, well, what's wrong with millennials? Or, you know, like, why aren't millennials, like, why are they different? And and of course, you know, a generation isn't just born with a dislike of church, or isn't just born with a different attitude about faith or God than the previous generation. There's something in our culture that was happening in our formative years that was different, that was shaping us and pushing us away. And that's what really, particularly that first section of your book, when you're talking about the reasons why, you know, no, maybe this is why I won't stay a Christian. I mean, you're identifying a lot of those things. That the problem isn't what's wrong with our younger generations. Yes. The problem is what's wrong with the society in which we were raised, the quote Christian society.
My gosh. I mean, it's just so typical, isn't it? What's wrong with those young people instead of what are we doing to drive people away? And that just then reinforces the whole problem. That's right. And oh my gosh, there are just so many dimensions to it. But you know, for us to be here in the United States, realizing that Christianity has a history here in the United States that we've never, that so much of it has been hidden. And so I, in telling the story of those first 10 chapters, I'm trying to, if people are going to stay Christian, I hope we can do so with our eyes open. Because if we don't learn to acknowledge all the things in our history and in the present that are driving people away, it's only going to get worse in the future. And not only that, if we don't acknowledge the ways that the Christian religion has really harmed large numbers of people, both Christian and non-Christian, by the way, if we don't really take that to heart, we increase the chances that even worse things could happen in the future. And this is one of the, I think, one of the reasons so many people, Brian, of your generation are saying, I do not want to be part of this thing that looks like it's about to cause a lot of harm. It's they're not saying, I really want to be an immoral person, so I'll leave Christianity. It's, I really want to be a moral person, and I don't want to get sucked into something that's doing harm.
Yeah. So as you noted, you have 10 chapters and part one is simply called no, right? The answer to this question, do I stay Christian? Part one is no. We'll get to part two eventually, but that's yes. But part one, and we won't walk through all these. And I encourage people to pick up the book and read through them. But just to give people a little bit of a taste, I mean, you talk about anti-Semitism, Christian versus Christian violence, crusader colonialism, institutionalism, money, white patriarchy, toxic theology, lack of transformation, constricted intellectualism, the changing demographics. So, I mean, you're really laying out some weighty issues there. And I don't know, I wonder if, particularly in light of what you just said, I mean, for some people, one of these or many of them might be the answer, why no? Like, this is why I'm not going to stay Christian. But you just made a comment about how for those of us who do stay Christian, you hope that we won't just, you know, skip this section, that we need to wrestle with these. And so I wonder, as you think about the state of American Christianity today, and I know you obviously think they're all important, you wrote about them, but is there one or two that you want to highlight as to why it's important for those of us who do stay Christian, and this is an audience and we're a Christian media organization, so most of our you know, listeners and readers are at least at this point staying Christian. What's something you hope that we will wrestle with our eyes wide open?
So, The first and the third chapter are about the harm that Christians have done to non-Christians. The first chapter specifically focuses on the harm we've done to Jews. And many Christians are totally unaware of the history of Christian anti-Semitism. And what they're also unaware that Christian anti-Semitism is having a really ugly resurgence. I happened to be in Charlottesville in August of 2017 on that day when the Unite the Right rally happened. I was part of the clergy counter witness that day. And I never expected in my lifetime I would see in an American city people walking down the street holding Confederate flags and Nazi flags and chanting Nazi slogans. So this, the harm done to Jews. And then in chapter three, I talk about the impact of the Crusades, which everybody has heard about, but not many people really have understood the dynamics of it and how long Crusades went on. And then how Crusades morph into the colonial period during which white European Christians conquer the world with a death toll that is staggering, almost impossible to measure. It's so great. And then on top of that, I talk about the life toll, meaning how many lives were harmed. Now, look, I grew up as a Christian being told when missionaries go to other countries, they bring great blessings. And there's some truth to that. I mean, many of the finest people I've ever met are missionaries, but we also brought along a lot of harm and exploitation and damage and on many levels. So those two chapters, I think, are really important for Christians to understand because, as I said a minute ago, worse things could be in our future unless we really face these things in our past. And those really stand out to me because they affect other people, that like people who are not Christians end up being hurt by our religion. But there are some chapters where I talk about the harm that we do even to Christians. And maybe I'll just mention one. I have chapter 9 is called Because of Christianity's Great Wall of Bias. And I talk about the problem of constricted intellectualism, of how many of us were taught to use our minds as intensely as we can to prove what we already think. And we were never allowed to use our minds to actually have curiosity and to maybe learn something that will overturn what we think. And my goodness sakes, I feel that because, you know, I live in Florida where our governor has, you know, has promoted laws that keep school teachers from teaching things that, you know, about our history, especially about our racial history, that certain people don't want everybody to know. And so that's another one that hits close to home for me. I mean, the fact that people could get master's degrees in divinity and never learn anything about the harm done by Christianity to other people, for a religion that's supposed to be about truth and honesty and repentance, that's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah. So I love that you brought that example, because one of the things that I've appreciated about you is that you do have an intellectual background, and that comes through maybe in subtle ways in your writing that people don't always get. I mean, you're best known as an author and a speaker, and you were a pastor for a number of years, and you were also an English professor for a number of years. And as one who's also kind of worn some of those hats, I've been a pastor, I was a professor of communication. Yes. And so at a university in Virginia, and so kind of not too far from where you were for many
That's
years.
Right.
You know, I appreciate that perspective that you bring. And so, you know, I know most people are thinking, you know, they think it was me, you know, I teach introduction to public speaking, you know, every, you know, freshman's, you know, most dreaded class that they have to stand on. But probably right up there with them is then they head over to the English professor.
That's right.
And they get these red marks, you know, all over their
papers.
But what is it about the experience that you went through academically, both as a student and as a professor? How has that impacted your faith and the way that you read scripture still today?
Sure. Well, you know, in the world of higher education, there's this idea of peer review. And the idea is that if you have an idea, you want to put it out there and you want it to be critiqued. And in fact, on your good days, you're kind of interested. Will anybody be able to poke holes in this? Because you don't know everything, and you have other people who are specialists in areas who might know things you don't know. And there's also the sense that no idea is above critique. You know, the whole idea of academic freedom is that no subject is forbidden and no conclusion is beyond question. In fact, one of the characteristics of science is that it's your duty to break up with the facts you used to believe if new data comes up that challenges those facts. And what's interesting to me, I couldn't have imagined this when I was a kid growing up. I couldn't have imagined this when I was 30 years old. But now it's so easy for me to imagine a form of Christianity that has that same openness to truth, that doesn't require foregone conclusions, that sees Christianity not as a set of conclusions that you have to reach or else make sure you stop asking questions, but rather sees Christianity as a pursuit of truth in itself. And inspired by a man who was absolutely committed to the truth and was willing to speak the truth to powerful people who didn't want to hear it. and who was able to speak in parables that challenge people to rethink long-held assumptions. So all that's to say that I think there is so much that I gained in my as a lit major, but just being involved in higher education, that has so enriched my faith and given me tools, I hope, to be a better Christian. I'm sure you feel that way because, you know, communication and English have a lot in common. We're interested in the how's a reasonable argument constructed and what are ways that people try to sneak falsehood around the edge by, you know, through little tricks or through little rhetorical tricks and so on. There's something about both of our disciplines that really is interested in truth.
That's right. Yeah. And in fact, that was why some of the outside classes that I took during my graduate studies were in the English department, because it kind of gets some deeper of the theory and some of the critical theory and some of those classes, you know, over there across the other side of campus that way. So, but you know, I think that's obviously we should transition to part two of the book, because you don't end with, these are all the reasons why not to stay Christian. You do then, you know, lay out some reasons why you suggest that someone could decide to stay Christian. And I think these are reasons why you are staying Christian. And, you know, I think the one that is probably the one that I hear more often. It may not be the case. I know you talk to a lot more people about these, but there is something about you call a chapter because of our legendary founder. And I do think you hear a lot of people that don't like to use the term Christian. Maybe they call themselves a follower of Jesus or something, right? There's something about they don't want to give up with Jesus, even though they're struggling with the religion in institutional sense. And so I wonder if we can maybe, what is it still about Jesus that despite all of these other things that have happened in the name of Jesus, it's like, well, I can't quit that.
Yeah. So here's where, you know, I know you from a Baptist background will understand this. I almost am in the realm now of testimony. And so, because here is my testimony. I've spent my entire life studying the Bible, and the second half of my life, I've been especially interested in the Gospels. And I honestly have to say, Jesus is more intriguing to me now than he was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. In other words, this is just honest truth. Absolutely interesting and compelling and all the rest. And here's, I'm not happy about this, but I'm just trying to report honestly. The traditional categories of Christian theology made Jesus less interesting to me. And when I just release him into the wild, so to speak, I let Jesus be a Jewish man under Roman occupation in the early first century. And I let him be in that economic, social, cultural, political world situation. He just becomes more and more interesting, and his words become more and more interesting. Like I was asked recently to preach on the Beatitudes, and I just have to say, whether you count 8 or 9 Beatitudes, there's a bit of controversy about that or difference of opinion about it. But however many there are, I just have to say, all Buddhists know the 4 noble truths of Buddhism, and they know, you know, the 8-fold path of Buddhism. And I just think, and Buddhists meditate on those truths and study. And I just think the 8-fold or 9-fold path of Jesus in the Beatitudes is absolutely magnificent. If that were the only thing he ever said, I'd be in awe of him, you know? So that's my honest testimony. Now, that doesn't mean a person has to stay Christian. I think Jesus is not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Christian religion. I think he is above it and beyond it. So I think Jesus is available to anybody. But the fact is that the Christian community at least is serious about cherishing and protecting the documents from which we learn a lot about Jesus.
Yeah, and another one of those, it kind of like the no section, you have kind of, I guess, your top 10 list. You've got the 10 chapters on yes, and we won't walk through all of them, but you got one that I have to admit, when I was first starting the book, and I even just saw the title on the table of contents, I got a little bit of a chuckle out. Because it would be a shame to leave a religion in its infancy. And you know, we're talking about this 2,000-year-old, you know, religion. Whatever you could share a little bit more about what you mean by that.
it's interesting. I was just on another interview right before this, and one of the members of the team was Jewish, and so you could say, if you want to start Judaism with, let's say, Abraham, then Judaism is about 1,400 years older than Christianity. And you can see that in many ways, Judaism is more mature. There are elements of Judaism that seem way more mature than Christianity. And, you know, when after September 11th, when it was so easy for Christians to spout all kinds of Islamophobic statements, Christianity is about 600 years older than Islam. And if you want to make a comparison, look at Christianity 600 years ago and see what all the mischief and trouble it was involved with, and you'll realize that we were not much farther, if any farther ahead. We may have been behind where Muslims are today. So all that's to say that and the other reason I wanted to write that chapter is because one of the problems with Christianity is it presents itself as if it's perfect, as if it's mature, as if it's complete. In fact, there's a whole way of being Christian where we think things were perfect in AD 33, or maybe we needed a few decades of Paul. Things were at their perfection at AD 67, and it's been all downhill since, you know. Our job is to stay as close to the original as we can. But what if Christianity is always evolving? It's impossible for it not to evolve, for the better or for the worse. If that's the case, then we could look at Christianity as a religion in its infancy, maybe even a religion with a certain kind of stunted growth because of some of the turns that different sectors of the religion have taken.
Yeah, and that idea of it always changing is another one of the chapters, and the for worse or for better.
Yes.
You also have a chapter about, and I think this is really important, because so much of our conversations about religion can be about God and about the divine, and obviously that's significant, but you have a chapter, Because I'm Human.
Yeah, so one of the realizations that hit me as I wrote the book, and I have to be careful about how I say this, because there's a way that clever religious people could use this as an excuse, and I do not use this as an excuse, but I realized that the problems that exist in Christianity exist to some degree in other religions, which, by the way, takes away the idea that Christians are better than anybody else, but they also exist in the American government, and they exist, like you and I were talking about higher education, that has so many wonderful qualities. But my gosh, we could critique higher education. It becomes necessary for people's economic advancement, and then prices itself so high that people will be in debt for decades if they get a good education, right? So we could critique that there are problems in every area of human life. And when I'm tempted to leave, what else do I want to leave? Do I want to say, well, Christianity is a bad reflection on my reputation? It's an insult to my pristine ego. Well, if I say that, then am I going to say, being an American is also kind of an embarrassment these days. We're kind of a struggling democracy, and we have this super high death rate from guns that are in the headlines right now. I'll get rid of my American citizenship. Well, where will I go? And then I'm a white male. White males don't have the best reputation right now either. Not much I can do about that, you know? And you start thinking, what is this urge to separate myself from everything that is human in a fallible sense? So then if I sit with that for a while, it's really ironic for me as a Christian. One of the ways we Christians understand Jesus as incarnation, God isn't trying to escape from humanity, distance God's self from humanity. God is bonding with humanity. And so then I wonder, then maybe one of the reasons to stay Christian is because I don't want to separate myself from humanity. I actually want to bond with it. And part of my humanity, as I came up in a Christian community, and maybe that's something instead of running away from, I should actually inhabit in the very best way I can.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
And then, of course, the last section of the book is titled simply How, Part 3. And you're wrestling with a lot of things in this part of the book. And I mean, I think obviously part of that is because, you know, so you go through, well, here's maybe the reasons no, here's the reasons yes. And what we don't want to do is just kind of, you know, jump back to, well, now we have a new set of simple, rigid rules, you know, back to stage one or stage two. It's just a different fundamentalism, maybe not of the right, but of the left or whatever it might be, right? It's a different set of structures. And so, you know, you're talking about trying to live out this faith that still keeps all of the doubt and the disappointment and the disillusionment there. It's not that we've now pushed it all aside.
Yeah.
So a couple of things I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, one of the things that, and I don't think this will be too much of a surprise to people if they've read some of your other works, but it's clear throughout this book, you have a lot of examples from nature, from creation. And I know that's something that's, you know, something that's you're passionate about. I wonder if you could talk about why that has been an area that it's really significant in your own personal life and in your faith in being out in nature, doing efforts to help, you know, combat climate change even, and why this is part of your faith and understanding of God.
Yeah. So I guess in some ways it's my parents' fault and it's and it's my fundamentalist Christian upbringing, because we took Genesis chapter 1 very, very seriously, which begins by saying God's the creator and God deems creation good. And for for 5 days, God says creation is good before there are any humans there. And we just get a minor mention on the sixth day, along with the cattle and the beasts that creep and so on. So you realize that there is an inherent goodness in creation, according to Genesis 1. And I don't think you have to take it literally in order to take it seriously. There's a goodness to creation. And if God is creator, then creation is, in fact, it's so interesting in Genesis 1, the creation happens by God just saying the word, let there be light, and there's light. And again, I don't think you have to take that seriously in order to say it means that light is an expression of God and gravity is an expression of God and the physics of motion are an expression of God. And I would say, the process of biological evolution is an expression of God. And if that's the case, then we have to take the universe very, very, very seriously. It's telling us something about God. The book, the first chapter of the book of Romans in the New Testament says that very thing. We really need to take creation, what we see in this world, seriously. But I'll tell you the other, and to me, that's just delightful. Like, I love the Bible. I've spent my life studying the Bible, and I feel like I read the Bible and I read creation, and they're both in introducing me to the same subject. And that's a big part of it. But then the second part of it is, in my 66 years of being a human on this planet, we have discovered that the way we're living on this planet as human beings is unsustainable. We've broken the balance. And the way we're living is catastrophically dangerous, not only to ourselves, but to every ecosystem on Earth. And if that's the case, then we have to learn from the Earth how to fit back in with those systems and patterns of the Earth. And that, to me, is deeply spiritual, and it's deeply ecological, and it's also just deeply pleasurable, because the beauty and delight that we experience when we enjoy this beautiful creation is, yeah, it's beyond words.
Yeah, it also, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but it also feels like, I mean, so climate change is, it's such a big topic. It's such a big issue. And it's easy to lose hope. It's easy to be like, Well, there's nothing I can really, I mean, you know, I can turn my lights off more and I can adjust my thermometer. And I know you go out and do some wildlife, you know, restoration efforts. I mean, you're really seriously engaged in this. And yet it's also such a small drop. But at the same time, I mean, that's what this whole book is wrestling with. I mean, here are the big issues, the big questions, the big problems with Christianity historically and in the present. You know, what little difference can I actually make? Why does it matter to even try? And a big part of your argument is that, like, it's, this is about who we are, what we're doing, who we choose to be, as opposed to maybe the more kind of, I don't know, capitalistic idea of, like, you know, well, it's all about the bottom line. And, you know, did we get more done this quarter than last quarter?
That's right. Oh my gosh. I mean, that subject of how our economic system shapes and forms our brain is one of the reasons why I think religion matters. We need, and why religion that's not under the control of money matters. We need some dimension of life that proposes a different value system than this almost godlike power of economics to shape our brains. But it's interesting. I just last week, my publisher and I agreed on what my next book is going to be. And it's exactly about what you just said. The tentative title is Life After Doom, acknowledging the fact that many of us wake up with a sense that the trend lines are not good. And I just came across a quote from the Czech intellectual Václav Havel, who listened to this quote. This is just, to me, I've been saying this and I didn't know anybody else that ever said it. And now that I hear it, I think, boy, he said it perfectly. Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something is worth doing no matter how it turns out. To me, that just says it, you know, that says it. The certainty that something is worth doing no matter how it turns out. And I realize, I mean, it's not like I saw that Václav Havel said that and decided I'm going to live by that. I realize that's what I've come to live by. When I saw those words, I said, oh, that says it. I haven't even been able to say it yet. And of course, I think that's resonates with definition of faith and hope and love that we find in the Bible. And I think that becomes really important. And that's one of the things that we need religion to do. We need religion to help us develop the conviction that some things are worth doing no matter how they turn out.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds a lot like a definition there of Hebrews 11:1, right? And thinking about faith. And I was thinking particularly the in the Cotton Patch Gospel version, in the way that Clarence Jordan puts it, faith is the turning of dreams into deeds.
I love it.
Yeah, this idea that even if it's not going to succeed, this is this idea of dreams, and we're going to live it out anyways. Yes. And it may stay a dream.
And the irony is, if you have a dream and you try to live it out, there's a chance it might happen against all odds. If you don't try to live it out, there's no chance it's going to happen. So in a certain sense, the impossible becomes possible as soon as you dare to say it's worth doing. And I think that is so much at the core. And this is, by the way, one of the things that I think we Protestants got in so much trouble about. We took the word faith, that I think whatever we're talking about here, call it hope, call it faith, this commitment to do what's right, even if it doesn't look like it's going to turn out. We reduce that to adherence to lists of words, adherence to systems of beliefs. Tragic. I mean, it's like going from something profound and mysterious and broad to something very flat.
You know, one of the things you made a brief reference to earlier, and it is actually one of the chapters that you have near the end, is this idea about, you know, being people of the truth. And you have a chapter about stay loyal to reality. You write in it, you know, for instance, that to be loyal to God is to be loyal to reality, and to be loyal to reality is to be loyal to God. And the, I don't know, those words really struck me because, I mean, we've seen the polling, BRRI and Pew and others about, you know, all of these conspiracies that are in our society right now, from QAnon, you know, the election, and, you know, all these things, and how prevalent they are among, you know, white Christians, particularly white evangelicals in our country. We clearly have a problem or a difficulty in staying loyal to reality. And so I know you're urging us to do that, but, you know, how do we push that in our churches? How do we help in our churches where these conspiracy theories are running rampant?
Something I wish I had said in Faith After Doubt. I implied it, but I wish I'd said it in one sentence. Here's the sentence I wish I'd put in there. Doubt is not the enemy of faith. Doubt is the enemy of authoritarianism. And I think one of our problems is that religion has become a hideout for authoritarians. And in a sense, when you have authoritarians who use religion as a place for them to exert power, as long as they can attract a crowd, they benefit. And then they turn the people in that crowd authoritarian friendly. So when that happens in religion, and then political authoritarians come along, all they have to do is get a few religious leaders to sign on with them, because the people will follow their authoritarian religious leaders to follow authoritarian political leader. And one of the ways, Hannah Arendt is the great 20th century scholar of authoritarianism. And she had a front row seat to watch Hitler, but also Stalin and Mussolini and other 20th century authoritarians. And one of the things Hannah Arendt said is that authoritarians barrage you with BS. They barrage you with lies. And it's not even so much that you'll believe their lie, because the next day they'll tell you a different lie. And the day after that, they'll tell you a different lie. Hannah Arendt said, what authoritarians do is they barrage you with so many lies that you give up on ever being able to know what the truth is. And when you give up on that, you're easy to control and manipulate and lead. My gosh, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? I mean, it just sounds familiar. And of course, Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin didn't have social media at their fingertips. And so then you realize we're also part of this huge human real life experiment in which we're connected by these little handheld devices to potential sources of truth or falsehood at every second. And if we're barraged with enough so that we can't tell them apart, you can almost see it being a way to render us vulnerable to authoritarians. We can't know what the truth is. And so some part of our brain says, what would I like to be true? Ah, I know what I'd like to be true. I'd like it to be true that people like me are the innocent victims, and we're pure, innocent, good people. And all of the problems in this world are because of that group over there. And I'd like to be able to project all of my anxiety on those people and hold myself up as this innocent victim. It's so predictable. Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Well, Brian, I just want to say thank you so much for writing this book and for all of the work that you have done throughout the years. For those that are interested, I do encourage you to pick up your latest book, Do I Stay Christian? A Guide for the Doubters, the Disappointed, and the Disillusioned. You know, earlier in our conversation, you made a reference to the fact that there's a lot of churches where if you've moved past simplicity or even complexity, that there's not a place for you.
Yeah.
And so as one of those voices that has been helping those of us to stay Christian, even before you wrote this book, been helping us to find a place when we didn't always have a church that had a place for us. I want to thank you for, you know, your voice and your pastoral work that you have been doing through your books for all of these years.
Well, Brian, that's kind of you to say. And can I say thank you for having this podcast? Because I think for a whole lot of people, thank God there are more and more churches that can help people move through the stages, can help people. They don't put a ceiling on people. They give people support, encouragement, and their growth. We need more. And there are many people. There is no church like that anywhere within driving distance from where they live. And I think it's podcasts like this that create a private space where people can imagine things being different. And so I'm honored that you invited me. Please keep up the good work. And it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.